This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Today, we're going to talk about male-female sex differences, and as important, why people are often reluctant to discuss whether such things even exist, to what extent they exist, and where they come from, how laws and customs should deal with differences in the sexes. Joining me are Christina Hoff Summers, an academically trained philosopher, which I guess is different than if you just pick it up on the streets, who's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She's the author of well-known books such as Who Stole Feminism and the War Against Boys. And I'm also sitting with Deborah So. She's an academically trained psychologist who has a PhD from Toronto's York University. And I'm going to read the name of her dissertation because it's up on her Wikipedia page. And I think it explains everything. It was called Functional and Structural Neuroimaging of Paraphilic Hypersexuality in Men. I'm sure we'll get to that.
I hope so.
Yeah. She writes frequently on gender and science issues for the Globe and Mail and Playboy, and she co-hosts a podcast called Wrong Speak for the website Quillette. Ladies, thanks for coming.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So this is The Reason Podcast, and we are taping in my apartment that's on Bleecker Street. There's going to be a lot of outside noise. I bring that up because oftentimes people start jackhammering or cutting down trees, it sounds like, but I hope the audience will bear with us. But first, let's talk about the current state of understanding in science about sex differences, and then let's talk about how society might deal with these differences in terms of policies or etiquette or customs and whatnot. You were both in town because you did a panel sponsored by the Independent Women's Forum called, the title was Who's Afraid of Sex Differences? Christina, why don't you explain briefly what the panel was about and, you know, how did you resolve that large question?
Yes, the Independent Women's Forum convened a panel of experts, Deborah and myself and Lee Jessam, a psychologist at Rutgers University, to talk about a topic that dares not speak its name, you know, the differences between men and women. And you ask, you know, what is the scientific consensus? I would say most scientists probably think quite reasonably that gender is a combination of culture and biology, a yet to be understood combination. And yet many on campus in gender studies and the various activist disciplines insist that it is a social construction, and even if they grudgingly concede that biology may play some role, that they think it's something. One feminist, for example, Virginia Vallian, compares it to something you could be inoculated against. She said, well, even if there are biological impulses towards, say, little girls playing with dolls, we inoculate children. Mm. We challenge biology. And so they're very confident that either it plays no role or it plays a role that's damaging to human liberty.
The three of you on the panel, the two of you plus the other scholar, Jessam, you all agree.
Yes. I would say we do. I mean, we see it as a combination.
Yeah.
I do think it's a combination, but at the same time that socialization can't override biology.
Okay. And I guess, is that really the question when we're talking about this kind of stuff? Most people agree there are obvious differences, but then it's a question of at what point do you either try to override the differences or ignore them?
Well, I think some people would even argue that there aren't differences and that we're focusing on things that don't exist. But of those who acknowledge that there are, I mean, I think that's more of the extreme end of things. But mm-hmm. for those who acknowledge that there are differences, that definitely it's all about socialization. This is something that should be prevented, that this is harmful to women, and that biology is basically a means by which people can justify sexism mm-hmm. and oppressing women.
Well, do you agree with that?
No, that biology oppresses women?
Not that biology oppresses women, but that oftentimes that people who want to structure society in a particular way will say, because of biology, women shouldn't be allowed to do this, or women can't do this, or the reason why, there were so few women doctors until now was because they're just biologically not good at medicine. The appeal to biology or to evolution.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think it's understandable why, say, a lot of women academics, and I, as a philosophy professor of many years, I mean, the history of philosophy, of theology, and of science is just littered with disparaging ideas about women, and these were harmful. They were false, and they prevented women from entering fields. I mean, women were thought to be too emotional and sensitive or inferior. And if you hear just terrible things, even Immanuel Kant, you know, thought women were incapable of understanding moral principles.
Well, and then there's always the flip side. I mean, and we're talking here about the kind of grand historical misogyny that was baked into, you know, a lot of society, but they're either incapable of being moral or they are super moral. And,
right.
you know, they're bound and rigid with morality. I mean, it can go either way.
Yes, they can be.
They represent nature or they represent rationality.
It's all sorts of projections. And just we had a distorted picture. Mm. And I think that what happened is for many scholars, they see how damaging this has been. And they just say, no, this is harmful to women. And I have had, when I've talked about sex differences, I've been challenged by people who say, you know, just stop this. Even if it's true, don't say it. These stereotypes are too harmful. And my answer to that is that this false stereotypes are harmful and we have to be careful. On the other hand, the answer to bad science and to, you know, distorted pictures of men and women, the answer to that is better science. And for that, you need free and open discussion. And we have too little of that in the academy and increasingly in the media.
I want to come back to Deborah in a second, but before I do that, Christina, could you talk a little bit about your I don't know what the proper rules of etiquette are here. I know your age because I've looked it up online and whatnot, but you came of age in school towards the end of the 60s and you entered the academy in the 70s and whatnot. You are very much a equity feminist. I mean, you believe in the, you know, that the goal of feminism or the practical political implication is that women should be treated as individuals, right?
Yes.
Describe, you know, why that was so central to your feminist identity and how is that linked to time and partly to this question of you're pushing back against, decades or an institution that did not really take women seriously.
Yes. And in my field, there were philosophy to this day, there are relatively few women. However, when I entered college and graduate school, I considered myself a feminist. I do today. I do not like male chauvinism, but I don't like female chauvinism either. I became a feminist because I believe that women should be treated as individuals, even if there are on average, the differences between the sexes as groups. There are many people that defy the stereotypes of the sexes. It's very complicated, not well understood. So you can't generalize. And the second thing is, when I became a feminist, it was fun. And it was, you know, we got to be as wild as the boys. It was equality. Now we have this kind of fainting couch feminism on the campus, where women are sort of fair maidens and damsels in distress, you know, falling onto their a chaise, you know, in the presence of male vulgarity. And this is, to me, reactionary. And people, you know, when I go and debate, students act like I'm reactionary because I don't.
Well, so you're you're like anti-MAME or something.
Well,
right?
I feel like just I was a hippie,
yeah.
You know, sort of a flower child, and we didn't like rules. And now it seems that feminism has become all about, you know, rules, and it's become authoritarian and not fun.
That's an interesting kind of shift from libertarian to authoritarian.
Yeah. You know?
Deborah, you mentioned earlier, and you know, talk a little bit about the academy. When did you get your PhD?
I finished a year and a half ago.
Okay, so relatively recent. What is the for you, what was the reigning model of feminism? And did you consider yourself when you entered for psychology, were you a feminist, or I mean, were you trying to do feminist psychology, or is this
Definitely not feminist psychology per se. But back then, I don't think that was even a thing. I mean, it's more recently that people are wanting to incorporate feminism into science. And now there is this growing discipline called feminist science, which I kind of question because I think science is supposed to be objective. So there shouldn't be any room for any particular ideologies.
But
in
it
there.
Could be something like that. You know, that. But I can see
Nick, not us.
Not our fault.
It's always the person you least expect. But I want to point out that I didn't take that call, so you guys have my attention. But I could see something like feminist psychology being, we're going to look at areas of psychology that have been underserved because they are about women's concerns or something like that.
Yeah, I could see that. And I think even 5 years ago, say, that would have been a valuable approach. But because feminism has gone off the rails, and especially within academia, the way it's manifested, I don't see it as being, I see it as being very biased now. But I did identify as a feminist, I'd say, even 5 years ago. And it's only with seeing how the mainstreaming of feminism has really taken it to stand for things that it didn't used to.
Could you, what would be an example of that? And do you not consider yourself a feminist now?
I'm still very much in favor of equality for women, of course, as a woman and someone with a PhD in a STEM discipline. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how STEM disciplines are sexist and discriminate against women, which I can talk about what I think about that as well. But in terms of an example, so back in the day, people would say feminists hate men. And I would say, no, that's not true. Feminists just want equality. We don't hate men. But now what you'll see is that some of the leaders of mainstream feminism today will openly say that they hate men and that men are trash and that masculinity is toxic. And so I don't think you need to say any of those things or believe any of those things to advocate for equality for women. So that's why I've kind of distanced myself from that label. Mm-hmm. I don't think it helps women. And I think it would actually benefit the movement if they were a little bit more open to men, because some feminists will say we don't have room for men in this movement, and I don't think that's useful.
Before we go on, let's get the quick the elevator pitch of your dissertation, functional and structural neuroimaging of paraphilic hypersexuality in men. What was that about?
I used 4 different types of brain imaging. So my PhD is in sexual neuroscience research, which is basically using neuroscientific techniques to better understand human sexuality. And with my dissertation, I looked at hypersexuality. So that is when people have excessive sexual behaviors. So some examples would be, it's known colloquially as sex addiction, although sex addiction hasn't actually been shown to be a medical condition. So sex addiction, so-called porn addiction, which is another thing that doesn't have any sort of legitimate research backing that up. So looking at the brains of these men, comparing them to, so men who are hypersexual and also paraphilic. So a paraphilia is an unusual sexual preference. So they're very kinky. They're into all kinds of different things.
This must have been the easiest study to get a subjects for?
Oh,
I'm assuming
definitely.
The student newspaper, you'd have people at the door.
I was very creative with my recruitment strategies. It was actually a lot of fun.
Did you find that there are, in the brain images, that there are distinct different patterns or?
So I found with paraphilias are akin to a sexual orientation, so they're not the same, but they are someone's primary sexual preference, and they aren't something that can be changed. So what I found is that, say, when you compare gay and straight men, the same network of brain regions activate when they're looking at gay and straight pornography based on their preference. Mm-hmm. And that same network would activate when kinky people are looking at the type of pornography that they prefer.
So to bring this back to kind of the conversation that we were in, Deborah, I think the first thing of yours I read was you were one of 4 people, 4 researchers who responded in Quillette, the online magazine, when James Damore's Google memo came out.
Yes.
And in that document, he was a programmer and he said, that among other things, that, one of the reasons why women were not represented in certain parts of Google was probably because women aren't necessarily that good at programming.
Well, I don't know that he said they weren't as good. He said more about the interests. So on average, women are not as interested in those STEM fields as men.
Right. And you, in your response, you said, that basically corresponds with, the current research.
Yeah. Biological influence, prenatal testosterone, not socialization in the way that Google was arguing.
How do you know, in that kind of case, because we're going back and forth between, there. So I think certainly we all agree, and I think most people, again, there's outliers, would agree that, there are clear differences between men and women, and we're evolved for different kind of functions and different purposes that are going to end up having some impact on how we go about our daily lives in a post-industrial world. But how do you know that it's just for the same reason that there weren't a lot of female doctors until, say, 1970. You know, and that was often interpreted as a sign that, well, women just couldn't do medicine, you know, couldn't be a family doctor. How do you factor out, even with STEM stuff, and you can say, okay, well, there's, you know, we can now say there's testosterone, there's this, there's that, but there are previous explanations for everything as well. Like, how do you know what is culture and what is nature?
Well, Christina here, yeah. I have an idea about that, and many have suggested this. You're absolutely right. Women were kept out of just about every field. And when the barriers came down, what you should do is just, what did women do? Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that women need mentors, women need workshops to, you know, get into physics or something. Well, they didn't need it to take over psychology, to mm-hmm. take over veterinary medicine, to take over psychology. There are entire graduate programs that are becoming, you know, approaching 70% female, when the numbers used to be very small in, say, veterinary medicine. So in the life sciences, in biology, women are, you know, now more female mm-hmm. biology majors than male. So there were certain fields that just women were attracted to and you couldn't stop us. Mm-hmm. There were some exceptions. Computers, basically the math-based disciplines, physics and engineering, computer science, you find fewer women. So then you ask, well, why would people say, oh, well, is it because it's a hostile environment and there's, you know, there are no mentors. Well, that was true of law. That was true of biology. It didn't. So you have to think there might be a different explanation.
Right.
And so you look and see that men on average have better spatial reasoning skills. This is cross-cultural. It's one of the best established facts in people who study sex differences. And women have better verbal skills and slightly better emotional intelligence. So, you know, they would have a comparative advantage in many fields and just be more interested. So, but there are women with fantastic spatial right. reasoning skills. It's just that the pool of women that might want to be computer scientists or physicists, mathematicians, is smaller than the pool of men. Hmm. So you shouldn't automatically assume that every time there's a gender disparity, it has to be oppression. Hmm. It could be just an innocent manifestation of preference.
Of viva la difference, right?
Yeah.
Deborah, you opted out of a kind of academic background, as did Christina. And, I want to hear you talk a little bit about that in a second, Christina, after having been in the academy for a while. But what kind of motivated you to be like, you know what, academics or the academic track is not for me?
Well, in the last 2 years, I noticed that the climate had changed quite a bit. In the last 2 years of my PhD, as I was nearing the end and I was deciding, am I going to continue on in academia, start looking for a postdoc or an assistant professorship? And what I noticed in mainstream media is there was so much coverage about the issue of transgender children and how early transitioning was the best way forward for these children. And so the younger, the better, basically. And so you'd see all of this coverage in mainstream newspapers saying, or outlets more generally saying, if you have a child that says they're born in the wrong body, the parents should affirm them and get them on pubertal blockers and give them a new name and change their haircut and their clothing or whatever, and showing how much happier apparently these children were. But from a scientific perspective, the best way forward is to actually wait until the child hits puberty and see how they feel. And the vast majority of these children desist, so they don't feel gender dysphoric. Once they reach puberty, they're more likely to grow up to be happy gay adults. And so no one was talking about this. Within the field of sexology, there's a very, you know, it's a consensus that we know this is the truth. But because of the history that sexology has had with trans activists going after sex researchers, if they don't like what someone says or what their research says, people are understandably intimidated. And so I felt I had to say something. It just didn't sit right with me. I would look in the comment section of a lot of these articles and parents would say, my son or daughter says that they are born in the wrong body. They want to transition. This seems very experimental to me. I don't feel comfortable as a parent. I don't know what to think. And all the comments subsequently would say, you're a bad parent, your child is going to kill themselves, you know, you're a bigot.
And your whole point is that, I say this as a parent, and also somebody who either did or is probably going to go through puberty sometime soon, that, I mean, like, you know, when you're talking about kids before puberty, like, you know, their feelings matter, and obviously as a parent, you know, and all of that, but like, you really don't base life decisions on a prepubescent child.
Kids say all kinds of things. Yeah. And the thing is, especially for very young children, when they say they are the opposite sex, what they really mean is they want to do things that the opposite sex does. Mm-hmm. And that's the only language that they have. So I wrote this op-ed for Pacific Standard, mm-hmm. Just to speak to the research. And I spoke to my colleagues and my mentors about it. And they've always been very supportive of me being outspoken. And they said, you know, I asked, should I wait until I have tenure to do this? And they said, even if you have tenure nowadays, it's not going to make a difference. You'll still get fired. So I said, well, I can't continue in a climate like that. I don't see the point for myself.
But that's also, I mean, in a way, just, you know, that particular point you're making about trans identity, it's actually kind of a good one, because there's a Fassbinder movie, forgetting the name of it, of a man who transitions to a woman and then realizes that she's made a mistake. I mean, like, you don't want to rush a decision like that. And if it's true that actually, you know, a lot of this is confused with sexual orientation, it seems like it's a happy resolution that to just let things develop.
You would think so. And I always want to emphasize, I do believe that adults should be allowed to transition if they feel that's the right way forward for them. But in this case, I mean, there's an overwhelming consensus with the scientific research showing that mm-hmm. all of the studies ever done on young children longitudinally show that the majority desist. So it doesn't make sense for them to transition because they likely are going to regret it. I think part of what it is that we look at what happened with the gay community. I've always been a very strong supporter of the gay community. I grew up in the gay community and all my friends were gay men. And people look at conversion therapy and how wrong they were. I mean, some people still do conversion therapy nowadays, and I think that's horrific. There's no evidence to suggest that sexual orientation can be changed. But I think that's part of where the resistance is coming from now, where people, some activists have conflated any sort of therapeutic interventions with gender dysphoric kids that tries to not encourage them to be comfortable in their body, but is open to saying, maybe you will outgrow this, let's just see what happens. Mm. They conflate that with conversion therapy. So that's why I think people are so uncomfortable at the idea that maybe let's not rush into transitioning.
Let's talk a little bit more about trans identity, because Reason has for many years had a trans person on our contributing editors list. And I grew up in New Jersey in the 70s where Renee Richards, who had been a dentist who wanted to join the women's professional tennis tour. This was like a huge story growing up. And obviously there's people like Bruce Jenner. What is...
You just dead named him.
Caitlin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Caitlin.
And the greatest economist in the world.
Yeah.
Deirdre McCloskey.
Yeah, that's who's been a contributing editor to Reason for years.
I think she should be, I mean, so famous. Yeah, and she's so brilliant, but somehow, you know, you get other...
She once, you know, she has a stutter, and this is a funny story. This is, I don't know, 15 years ago or so. I put together a special panel at the Modern Language Association annual convention, which is for literary departments. And Deirdre was one of the people, the panel was on something like non-Marxist materialist approaches to literary and cultural production or consumption or something like that. And she started talking, and she has a stutter, and she had just transitioned. And a lot of people in the audience, she was well known among English people, scholars, because she did a lot in the rhetoric of authority and economics and in composition and whatnot. But she started by saying, you know, in my life, I've been many things, a Marxist and a man. And people were like, I mean, they did not know, how to deal with it. And it was funny because for them, the fact that they were expecting Donald or D.N. McCloskey, which were her previous names before she became Deirdre as she was transitioning, it was less that they were now seeing a woman, and it was more that... or a stutterer, and it was more that they were seeing a capitalist, because they had expected that Deirdre McCloskey, you know, had to be a lefty because they liked her. But what I was going to ask is, you know, from what I've read, the trans population is about 0.3%. of the population, generally
it's
speaking?
3 in 1,000. It's doubled in the last 10 years to 6 in 1,000
okay.
now.
So I'm, but it's, and not to say that because it's small, it doesn't matter, but it seems that why are we talking about trans identity so much now? Like what is it speaking to? Is it a set of cultural anxieties that, I mean, it seems to have, we talk about it much more, you know, more than the sheer numbers would seem to hazard.
I think that what happened was, I mean, first of all, it is, in my opinion, a legitimate, you know, liberation struggle, mm-hmm. because there are people who are legitimately trans, in the, you know, trans identified.
Oh, yeah, and it's horrible. I mean, like,
and it's horrible. And
trapped.
When meeting people like Deirdre McCloskey and reading the stories, I am quite sympathetic. However, we didn't really have a chance to have a full hearing of, you know, the various arguments. And what happened was they came in very quickly after the, I mean, you had women's rights, we've had the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and gay rights. And they came in right after and just appropriated all of the assumptions and the arguments, and that, you know, to do anything that was against their, what they wanted, was suddenly like, being a racist or being a sexist.
You and now being, you, as a second wave feminist, you are not a TERF though, right? You're not a trans exclusionary radical feminist.
No.
Because there's also that odd.
There's that. It's very
pushback.
Interesting. And now the TERFs, who are mostly, not exclusively, but a lot of lesbian women, mm-hmm. who don't like men or do not, who want to have safe spaces and, mm-hmm. and male places that exclude males, now they feel like they're threatened, and they want to have female spaces. And I, you know, I can understand that. I think we should try to accommodate people. But now they've oddly made sort of excommunicated from the left,
right?
And they're turning up at places like Heritage Foundation.
Wow.
And it's so interesting.
Yeah. And I guess part of it is also that some of the changing, if not definitions, kind of sensibilities around what it means to be trans. Because in the 70s and 80s, it seemed to be all about surgery.
Well, it was transsexual people, yeah. who, and that's where I'm sympathetic. But now what's happened is you have a lot of young people that just suddenly declare themselves trans with no intention of doing anything to change their sex,
right.
They just declare it's very fashionable.
Trendy.
It's trendy. It's,
yeah.
cool.
Deborah, speak to that. Is you know, and I assume that it's trendier among younger people. My younger son, who you know, graduated high school recently, in his class, you know, there were always a couple, almost exclusively girls who were transitioning to be men or boys, but. How much of this, you were saying earlier that sexual orientation is not really remediable. It's not, you're not going to be changing.
And it's, sexual orientation is linked with gender identity too.
Yeah. So what is that? You know, how do those things come together? And then, you know, is this, you know, is, obviously there are trans people, but then there's also a lot of people who are kind of trying it on for size. I mean, is that, you know, is there a way to figure out what is the percentage of people who call themselves trans who are actually just experimenting?
Right. So previously, when we look at, say, gender clinics of children, it would be for male patients. So it'd be mostly boys who are very feminine. And then in the last 10 years, there's been a sudden switch in the sex ratio, and now it's predominantly girls. And I've written about this issue before. It's called rapid onset gender dysphoria. Not necessarily all of these girls, but there is definitely this phenomenon of young women who have no history of being gender dysphoric. So I don't know if that's necessarily the case of your son's classmates, but these girls will come out as transgender, often completely out of the blue, one after the other. In some cases, in friend groups, it'll be more than half of the friend group coming out as transgender, which suggests that it is like a social contagion. Mm-hmm. And Lisa Littman, she's a physician and researcher at Brown University. She published the first study on this, and then all hell broke loose after.
Is that the study that disappeared?
It's quote unquote under review right now, even though it was peer reviewed before it went out. So it meant that other experts would have looked at it and vetted it and said, this is good to go to the public. Mm-hmm. And then it's since been deemed needing to be reviewed because of its methodological.
Well, to tie it back to your decision not to pursue an academic vocation, how much of it is that the academy is just not the you go into science or you go into advanced scholarship in order to ask questions and research things and discover new stuff? And is it that the climate for any kind of free and open exchange of ideas is just not there anymore?
Yeah, it's completely gone. It's gotten even worse since I left a year and a half ago. Whereas researchers now, they see these things happening, like what happened to Lisa being mobbed and attacked and called all kinds of awful things, even though she's just trying to genuinely understand this phenomenon. So other people say, well, I don't want that to happen to me, so I'm going to avoid any sort of topic that could be potentially contentious, or if I do publish anything about it, I'm going to make sure that those findings make people happy.
What do you think is driving that narrowing of acceptable discourse? And here we're not talking about, bringing, an idiot provocateur speaker to campus. I mean, we're talking about faculty members doing the research. What do you think is driving the narrowing of what's acceptable?
I think the fact that activists or anyone, social media plays a huge role, because these institutions, funding agencies, they don't want to deal with even one or two very vocal, angry people saying that you are racist, sexist, bigoted, transphobic, whatever. So I think that's part of it. And I think it's also partially the culture of academia, where professors and researchers are busy enough as is. They're super stressed out. It's a very competitive environment. Based on your research and getting funding alone, you don't want to have to deal with mobs on social media coming after you on top of that. And they see their colleagues being shamed. And so, I lost my train of thought. I wanted to actually go back to what we were talking about with prenatal testosterone, though. I think that's where I was deviating. But
that's where it all begins. Right?
That's where it all begins in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity, and that higher exposure to testosterone is associated with more male typical interests and behaviors, whether you are male or female. So if a female fetus is exposed to higher levels, she's more likely to be male typical when she's born, and also more likely to be lesbian, attracted to women. So that's the other thing with rapid onset gender dysphoria. A lot of these girls are actually lesbian, but because society is still homophobic, it's gotten better, but I definitely would think homophobia is still a problem. It's easier nowadays to be a trans boy than it is to be a lesbian girl.
Christina, talk about your transition out of academia, because then this happened by the time you did that, you had already had a successful academic career. Were
yes,
you a
I had
full
tenure.
Professor or associate?
I was an associate professor. I had tenure at Clark University.
Yeah.
And I started to just write about, I started with giving a paper at the American Philosophical Association challenging some of the central theories in feminist philosophy at the time, and they were all heavily Marxist. I had been asked to teach a course on feminist theory, and so I sent away for the books, and I was appalled by what I found, because I thought, I guess, that it would be like every philosophy textbook, that you'd have like just great arguments on both sides of some contentious issue, that we would be debating, I don't know, surrogate motherhood and affirmative action or abortion, and instead it were these eccentric theories about women's oppression, and they were just it was warmed over Marxism. They just crossed out class and put gender.
Well, that somewhere in my bookshelf, I think I have a copy of Shulamith Firestone's The Dialectic of Sex, which was a popular bestseller, and it quite openly said, I'm basically taking the Communist Manifesto and I'm doing a search and replace for class or proletariat and putting women in.
Yeah.
Using
and in that book, I think she is that book where she had the idea that we could make babies in laboratories?
Yes, no,
and just liberate ourselves from biology.
It is actually on a certain level, it is the work of a mad person.
Yeah.
And on another, it is this brilliant kind of
it is brilliant and kind of fun
manifesto. And it has this huge chart at the end where it's like where the goal was that not just women, but humans would be liberated from their bodies.
Right.
And so you could have babies outside, in a lab, which, there's...
We may be moving that way.
Hopeful. Yeah, I'm kind of hopeful.
I think that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's, so...
But anyway, I was asked to teach. So I just thought, there are a lot of fallacies here, and I'll point them out. So I went to the APA, to the Society of Women in Philosophy, and something happened that usually if you're there and you read a paper, people are very critical and you hash it out and then you go out for drinks. We did not go out for drinks. There were people in the audience who, as I was speaking, were stomping their feet and hissing
I mean, it was like a struggle session. They were philosophers. And I lost friends. I was excommunicated from a religion I didn't know existed. So then I just started to write about it. And specifically, I went on this ship called Semester at Sea. And it was about 30 professors and 500 kids. You go around the world. And I was a professor with these 30.
Were you, this is starting to sound like Moby Dick, were you alone, returned?
No, we all came back. Okay. But there was like the kids, like 500 young Republicans, you know, from rich, from USC. And I don't know, they were they didn't get along with the faculty. And the faculty, there were several Marxists and this very angry feminist named Carla. And here, the ship had a disproportionate number of girls, obviously rather privileged. You know, Daddy had paid for their trip around the world, but Carla convinced them that they were oppressed. And by the end of the trip, they hated the boys. And actually, the boys didn't behave all that well because of the ratio. They were... they didn't mind that there were so many girls. But anyway, I was appalled.
How this has not been a miniseries, I escaped.
I was just appalled by the dogma and the waste of time. We would come into ports, and they could go and see, you know, some of the world's most amazing, you know, architectural works of genius. And Carla would take them to wedding stores to see, you know, what that told about the oppression of women in Cadiz, Spain. And, you know, it was just too much for me. So I wrote a piece about it called Professor at Sea, kind of making fun of the leftist professors. And I ended up palling around with the kids. I started to smoke. I had stopped, but I needed a cigarette.
So they were going to, gynecological clinics and wedding stores. You were going to strip clubs with all the frat boys?
No, we went to the Alhambra. Okay. And, you know, we were in Cairo, and we'd go see the Cairo Museum and things, and they would be off deploring this and that. It was just an experiment. It was so negative and it was so false. So I wrote about it and I sent it to the Atlantic. And the editor, this wonderful editor there, I don't think he's there anymore, Michael Curtis, just said, so, you know, I he couldn't use this article, but he said, but it's so interesting. You're criticizing feminism as a feminist and you're an academic. And I want to hear more about that. He said, write about the state of feminist theory and women's studies. So suddenly I was a journalist. And I enjoyed it. And that became the basis for my book, Who Stole Feminism? Hmm.
Do you, and Deborah, I have this question for you as well. Do you worry, though, I mean, I guess this is kind of a question of practice. You know, there is a difference between being at a think tank or being a journalist and being an academic. And I realize that, you know, academia can be a suffocating, stultifying environment. But do you worry that you're losing your chops by... Well, writing for a general audience or not being in that discourse community that you were part of?
Well, I had taught for many years and I enjoyed it. But I was getting a little tired of it. It gets repetitive and you do find yourself, at first you're very young. And, you know, I used to worry that I looked younger than the students and I kind of put glasses. I tried to make myself look more serious. And then after a while, I was the age of their parents and then older than their parents. So it was fine to move on. And a think tank is like a university without students. So you don't grade papers. That was liberating. And I was just free to write. Mm-hmm. And so I still, like, I wrote The War Against Boys and One Nation Under Therapy and other things at AEI. That's me. Sorry. And I...
Unless it's Paris Hilton, we're not picking up.
I was able to write scholarly books in the sense everything tied to research and to good numbers, but for a general audience. Mm-hmm. And it was just fun and liberating, and I communicated with far more people. Mm-hmm. And now I found by accident, if your lectures are posted on social media or you do videos, you reach an even larger audience. So I like sort of bringing my talents as a teacher and an academic philosopher to a wider public.
And we love the factual feminist.
Oh, thank you.
Deborah, how do you know that you're keeping up with your research interests or, you know, where the sub interests that you're in are going, if you're not part of academia?
Well, I read all of the papers as they come out, and I stay in touch with all of my previous colleagues, and many of my friends are still in the field, and mm-hmm. I'm so proud of them. One of my close friends actually just got a faculty position, so I'm super happy for him. But I see what they have to deal with, and in a way, I feel it's kind of like a very complementary relationship that we have. So they're producing the research, but if they deal with any sort of backlash or people misrepresenting their work, they reach out to me, and then I say, okay, let me see, is there something here that I can help to clarify what you meant by that paper? Or I mean, on both sides. So we have, say the far left or leftist activists, and I still consider myself a liberal, but I say the ones who are a little bit more ideologically driven, who will take, say, a paper about rapid onset gender dysphoria and say this is a bigoted scientist. But you also have it on the other side where, say, research that is more sex positive gets turned into something very salacious or extrapolated to mean things that the researcher didn't mean. So on both sides, I try to help correct for misrepresentation in the media.
Well, what is your typical reader? Do you have one? And, you know, and I guess this is a more general question of, we, you know, increasingly more and more people go to college, more and more people are interested in ideas. You know, I mean, it's fascinating. There's, you know, people are really hungry for ideas. And one of the things that has, developed in kind of new media or online media, it always used to be, you know, if you're going to do something online, make it 15 seconds, make it 30 seconds. Nobody has any attention. And in fact, you look at, you know, the most popular podcasts, the most popular video series, oftentimes will go on for hours on a topic because people are really interested in this stuff.
Like the long form podcasts.
Yeah. And what, who are your readers, do you find, or do you, what kind of comprises your audience?
I get a lot of feedback on social media, which I really appreciate because I get to hear from, I'm not a social media person. I don't have social media for my in terms of my personal life. If it wasn't for work, I don't think I would be on any of these platforms. So it's good in a way. It keeps me up with the times, and I get to hear from people all over the place telling me what they think. My sense is most people are quite educated. Some of them are current academics or former academics. And I think in terms of politically, many people like me who are, say, liberals but are a bit disenfranchised, conservatives, and I think also people who are just, or maybe people who feel that they don't really fit into either camp. But I think the more prevalent trend I notice is just people who are open-minded and really want to understand what the truth is. They may not agree with me on what my opinions are, but they understand my method and that I'm just trying to present the data in a way that is fair and not be swayed by political agendas.
And she writes for Quillette. Mm-hmm. And I will say there are just certain places right now that are so exciting. And I would say Reason is one place, the podcast, the magazine, the forum, the website, definitely. And Quillette, Heterodox Academy. Mm-hmm. And there's just other places where you're just finding people that are not automatically giving in to the dogmas, because it used to be, I don't know, a place like the New Republic, you could have read kind of informed opinion that it was quirky, you couldn't predict, but it's become predictable. Mm. And this has happened to other places. So I love what you do.
Thank you.
Mutual admiration.
Well,
here.
Let's talk a little bit about, okay, so, you know, we stipulate that there are, you know, if evolution is true, you know, men and women are going to have certain, you know, are evolved to be different in particular ways that are going to end up influencing or affecting or impacting our day-to-day lives, even, you know, once we're off the savannah and we're, you know, we're in New York City or Toronto or DC. Christina, where is a place where those differences, which we're not going to be able to remediate, you know, fully anyway, and public policy or outcomes that we want that are more equal, say, where is a big place where those brush up against each other? And then how do we as a society talk about that?
Well, as I said before, you have to be careful about insisting that there are differences where there aren't. There are a lot of ways to go wrong, and people are complicated. So you have to be careful with any individual. You have to treat them that way, because you just you can't determine someone's personality by knowing their gender. However, there are group differences. And so if you ignore these and just pretend, oh, well, you know, everyone's the same, or we can push everyone to be the same, gender neutrality or something in teaching methods, you are likely to end up
doing harm. And I'll give an example. I wrote a lot about boys, the war on boys, and you find increasingly classrooms are unhappy places for a lot of little boys, because the characteristic play of male children cross-culturally is rough and tumble play. And there's a lot of sound effects, mock fighting, and just rambunctious, raucous play. Girls do it too, but boys do it a lot more. And increasingly, mothers, parents in general, and teachers don't like it. And there are experts on, you know, playground dynamics, like Anthony Pellegrini at the University of Minnesota. And he says, look, this is the happy, normal play of little boys everywhere. And in fact, we even see it in monkeys. I mean, similar male styles.
So now you're comparing boys to monkeys.
Well, it just suggests, you know, they're not captive to the culture, you know, the gender. It wasn't enforced on them, the gender binary. And if you see it in vervet monkeys and the little, you know, females want to go for more doll-like toys, and the males go for gadgets, and you begin to think there's something there. There is something there for most children. And so if we, let's say we have policies where we cut back on recess, we don't allow rough and tumble play, that's going to have a disparate impact on boys. And now there are other things we could do that would be harmful to girls. So you have to keep in mind that there are these differences. And for example, the way parents react to having a child. Typically, the mother is just, you know, profoundly attached. It's harder for most women, not all, but most, it's harder to leave the child. And if you look at preferences, you find that a majority of women would prefer, once they have children, actually prefer to work part-time or not at all. It's a small percentage, about 20% of women that are just high-powered careers. Mm-hmm. Nothing, you know, will deter them, and they're very ambitious. But yet we have an entire women's movement that's sort of ignoring maybe 80% of women who want something else. So so that's what I'm saying, is that you're not driven by, you know, over generalizing. But on the other hand, if you ignore it, you're likely to pursue policies that are harmful or at least unhelpful.
Deborah, is there an issue for you where it's, you know, kind of who we are evolved to be comes into conflict with, you know, what we want society to be?
I think it's seen that way sometimes, but it doesn't need to be. So say when we look at evolution, and my area of research previously with regards to human sexuality, men and women have evolved to be different. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But nowadays, I think, especially with current day feminism, the emphasis is that women and our behavior should be identical to men. And this is not just with regards to career. It's also in our personal lives with sex and dating. Men and women have evolved to be different in terms of mating strategies. You know, there's millions of years of evolution. So even though we have birth control now and we'd like to think that we are more evolved, we can't override that programming.
So how does that cause conflict? I realize, again, you know, everyone is an individual, but there are group differences. What are the salient differences in kind of like mating strategies between men and women then?
One theme I'm seeing a lot in terms of the people who reach out to me is young women saying, I'm not interested in casual sex, but I'm being told that this is what liberated women do. And if I do it, it doesn't make me happy. So is there something wrong with me, or why do I not like it? And it just makes me sad to hear these things, because I think, you know, do what makes you happy. If there are some women who enjoy casual sex, that's great. There are some men who don't enjoy casual sex. And, you know, it is considered, I guess, stereotypical behavior. I don't think stereotypes have to be a negative thing. I think we can acknowledge that on average, men and women behave differently, but you know, that's okay. It's not saying that one is better than the other. My issue is that when we try to suppress this information, if it's harming young women and young men in terms of the decisions they make, how they interact with each other, and ultimately the relationships that they have, that's not a good thing.
Just as a final kind of topic to think about, and Christina, let's start with you. You know, One of the interesting things when you talk about a lot of topics, and certainly things like racism and sexism, homophobia, whatnot, everybody would agree, I think, that there's been an enormous amount of progress made towards equality and individualism and, you know, acceptance in general. But how do you, you know, But there's also a lot of people who want to deny that any progress has been made or that it doesn't matter until we're all across the finish line. How do you measure progress in relation to kind of women's position in society? And what do you think still needs to be done that's not getting done?
Well, for me, I guess I'd be kind of a preference utilitarian, or I want to, to me, a flourishing, healthy society is one where there, people can pursue what interests them. They can be who they, you know, high levels of just self-realization. And, you know, I think we are a very admirable society in that respect, always room for improvement. But as you said, there's a negativity, there's an unwillingness to look at how far we've come. And now we have so many in the women's movement that are just fixated on disparities. Any disparity that favors men is automatically attributed to sexism. And what I want to point out is that first, there could be other explanations. And secondly, what about the disparities that favor women? I mean, if it's a big problem that, you know, more than 70% of the majors in engineering are men, is it a problem that the more than 70% of the psych majors are women? And I want some consistency there. I don't understand. And the other thing is there's a huge asymmetry in terms of representation. There are untold numbers of organizations who are looking out for women. And that's fine. I mean, we needed them. We especially needed them in the 70s and the 80s. But what happens when you're the American Association of University Women, you know, when you're in the 60s or 70s trying to work for women to be given a chance in the academy? And then what happens when, you know, the 80s, women achieve parity with men, and then in the 90s move beyond, and then, you know, approach 60%, 65%. At what point do you say, okay? They never say okay.
Well, it's like the March of Dimes, right? I mean, polio was licked in the 50s.
Yeah, and, you know, you find
still
something else.
Shaking us down.
No, that's fine. There still are, you know, there is misogyny in the, mm-hmm. particularly in the popular culture. Even though I think the most men are not sexist, there still are, sexists out there. We still need feminism, and I think we especially need it across the globe, where women have not had the benefit of two major waves of feminism. They have had hardly a trickle. So there's a need for a women's movement, but it should be reality-based. It should be have goodwill towards men. And it's something I also think men and women do together, and not turn it into a zero-sum game. You know, it's Venus against Mars, and we're rooting for Venus. I'm rooting for both. Men and women, we're in this together.
Deborah, what how do you measure progress, and what do you think is the a feminist kind of victory that hasn't been achieved yet?
That's a good question, because I don't really feel like there's much in North American culture, Western culture. I don't really feel like there's much that women cannot do that men can do. I'm thinking about movements more recently, like say Me Too. I think Me Too had a good core message in the beginning, and it too has kind of dissolved into something else. But, you know, I think as long as women can do what they find interesting and are free to do what makes them happy, that's what matters. It doesn't matter whether we are identical to men. I don't think that is a sign that we are truly liberated or that we are necessarily happier, because in some cases, behaving more like men, that doesn't lead to greater happiness for women. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been Nick Gillespie, and we've been talking with Christina Hoff Summers of the American Enterprise Institute. Christina, what's the best place to get your podcast?
Well, just go to at Femsplainers on Twitter, and you'll find messages about our podcast. And follow me on Twitter, CH Summers.
All right. And we've also been talking with Deborah So, who is a psychologist who writes for the Globe and Mail and Playboy and Quillette. And you do a podcast with, co-host a podcast with Quillette called Wrong Speak. Where's
Wrong
the best
Speak.
Place to get that?
You can find all my work on social media. I'm at Dr. Deborah So on Twitter and Facebook, Dr. Deborah W. So on Instagram. So I post all of my columns, Wrong Speak episodes, and all of the wonderful media interviews I do, like the one today.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Check us out at Google, at Apple, at Reason, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. Subscribe and let us know how we're doing. Thanks.